From the Draco Vista Studios in Phoenix, Arizona, unlocking secrets of writing, conversing with masters of the craft, and just having a lot of fun. It's the Dragon Page, cover to cover.
Hey, welcome to another exciting episode of Dragon Page Cover to Cover. I am Michael Stackpole.
And I'm Michael Armanenge.
Great. So this means you're not going to flub any names during the show?
Awesome. Cool.
That's that superpower, apparently. Whoever goes in, you know.
Is that it?
That's it.
I already screwed that up with Nina. So
No, you pronounced it correctly.
I didn't. Yeah. Nina Mutineau.
Yeah, well, now you're screwing it up.
Yeah,
but you got it right the first time.
Yeah, well, it's...
All right, so we've got an interview coming up that you guys will have. It's actually a really good interview, and it'll be the bulk of the show.
Mutineau. That's it.
And and we will...
I'm practicing here.
That's good. Yeah, okay, that's good. That's good. But did you have something you wanted to open the show with, or are we just going to natter on?
We're just going to natter. Yeah, we're just going to chatter for a second because it was actually a long interview.
And it was.
A great interview. Because if you've been asking us for more shows about writing and how to write and what it takes to be an author and so forth, this is that show.
Yeah.
So if you're tired of the ebook conversation, if you're tired of all the other conversation, here we go. We're getting back down to the brass tacks of it all. And that is, how do you start this thing, this crazy profession called writing?
Well, I actually think we've had two interviews in a row that really have done this, because talking to Chip Delaney last week.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, we were able to get into some of that. And, you know, just so you guys know, just a little background here on how we do the show. Our interviews are fairly organic. I mean, we pick up on where the author wants to go and pick up on interesting things that they say. And I think most of you get that if you listen to what we're doing. We don't sit here with a
laundry
script.
List of things to talk about. Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, we're able to, and at any time, I think we'd all be willing to talk to writers about how they write and what they do. You know, the question is, do they seem to be receptive to that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is that something that they just want to do? So
I think what I would like to do is throw the call out to those of you out there that are actually, this could be ugly or it could be really great. I'm not sure. Those of you who are trying to get published,
right,
that are doing some writing and so forth. Maybe just short conversations. Not going to be a long interview. We're not going to basically ask you about your entire life. But, you know, four or five minutes, if you'd be willing to talk to us for 4 or 5 minutes and just kind of talk to us about what you're doing and how you're doing it,
that
could be fun.
Yeah, and a variation on that. If you can do it, if you are a beginning writer or just a writer with questions, and you can come up with a general question and send it in like voicemail, keep it under a minute. Okay, so no more than a minute. What we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and screen those, and then we may use those questions when we're interviewing an author.
Oh, that's a great idea.
We'll play a listener question,
mm-hmm.
and you'll get to see what their reaction is and what their take is on things.
Oh, I think that's even a better idea. That's a much better idea.
So, well, that's based out of the discussion we had after the interview with Chip Delaney last week. We chatted with him a little bit about, you know, trying to set up some of that, because he was just a fascinating interview. If you haven't listened to that show, please go ahead and do it. A fascinating interview, and he teaches writing, and that would be an avenue for you to get some really good advice from, you know, aside from the fact that Mike and I actually know what we're doing, you know, getting some other people in here that that know what they're doing is certainly a good thing. So
no, I think that's a great idea. Yeah. So just generic questions.
Right.
And I'll put them in a little folder, and when we're having these conversations, these interviews with people, we'll shoot them out there and see if we can't
absolutely
get some responses and some answers for you. I think it's a brilliant idea. So,
yeah, so.
Well, tell us what you think. You know the numbers, 206-350-READ. That's 206-350-7323. Hang tight. We will be right back with
our interview with Nina.
Nina, absolutely. It's one that you will not want to miss. So here you go.
Have you ever found yourself in this situation?
Oh, he was trying to pull an Angel and Sharon dumped him.
What?
Or this situation.
My boyfriend just totally turned into Parker. Why is it that the men in my life have to become such a mirror of Buffy's social and interpersonal life?
What?
Or perhaps you found yourself in this situation.
And there was I thinking, why didn't the Alliance come up with a way to reverse the process on the Reavers when I realized that if...
Is this about that Josh Whedon thing again?
Never mind.
If this is you, then have we got the podcast for you. Let's Talk Joss.
Join us every month as we discuss Joss Whedon topics in depth with various fans of his works.
Topics range from the lighthearted to the seriously in-depth.
So visit us at letstalkjoss.com.
Or if you'd like to participate, email us at letstalkjoss@gmail.com.
And back with more Dragon Page cover to cover, I'm Michael R. Menengay.
And I am Michael Stackpole.
And joining us on the phone is... I forgot to ask how the last name is spelled. How do you pronounce
it? You can't say my name.
I cannot. It's Nina
Muntianu. Actually, you're saying it the right way.
Really?
It's supposed to be Muntianu, but I can't even say that.
Muntianu.
Okay, all right.
Well, I've never been accused of pronouncing a name properly, so thank you for that.
Apparently, I did the lead-in on this show.
There you go.
Well, other than butchering your name, thank you so much for joining us.
And we're hoping you're having okay time in a hotel that the staff has forgotten or something on that order.
Yeah.
Right. I know. Like, well, there you go. At least they left the lights on and the heat.
Well, that's very important.
Yeah,
thank God for good things.
Well, we're starting out on an interesting note here, but I think that we have something at least really cool to talk about.
Okay, cool. Is that my book by any chance?
Yes, that would be. Yeah, there we go. Yes, this is great.
Oh, definitely cool then.
Yep, absolutely.
So tell us about this book.
Okay, well, hey, it's a book about writing.
Awesome.
Which is one of my favorite subjects. It's called A Fiction Writer, Get Published Right Now. And of course, it's a homonym, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm really bad at. I'm probably one of the world's worst spellers, so I do it without even realizing it. So it's spelled right, as in, you know, to write a book.
Right.
Anyway, but hopefully it'll teach you to write the other way, as in the R-I-G-H-T. And it's what I've done is I've compiled the wisdom of many expert writers. Including, I think, Michael Stackpole's in here. It's possible. But anyway, a number of people who've written all kinds of stuff. I'm a science fiction writer myself, so it leans a little bit toward those people, like Robert J. Sawyer and a bunch of others, Larry Niven. And I've taken all the best things that they've said and put it together in an ABC guide that runs anywhere from alien architecture to blazing beginnings, outlines and synopses, get sensual, and right at the very bottom, you're probably wondering what goes under Zed. It's the Zen of passionate writing. So I even have a whole chapter on rejections, which includes some of my very best rejection letters. So it's awesome. You can actually see a couple of rejection letters that I got, anywhere from those, you know, wonderful form letters that just basically say, I don't know what they say, thank you, but no thank you.
Right.
They don't even have a signature to something that's scrawly handwritten and says, love to see more of your stuff. And what I do is I dissect the meaning behind these cryptic remarks.
Very good.
And that's just one chapter.
That's very cool. Yeah, we say it on this show all the time that you know, rejection letters should be your badge of honor. You know, don't look at them as a bad thing. That's what you want. You want to get rejection letters until you get that acceptance letter.
There you go.
Well, for sure. I the way I say it in the chapter too is I mean, basically rejection letters are a way of finding out what the market's like,
mm-hmm.
and determining who are your best candidates. You know, if you turn it around and see it the other way, you find out about them by, you know, what they say to you and all that kind of stuff. And it's really just a business transaction, because it's basically saying, well, we don't have room right now, but, you know, maybe later on we do. And often there's a language there that can establish a relationship. And I know people have had many rejection letters from the same source and actually developed a relationship with that publisher to the point where they did publish eventually. So
yeah,
it's a learning experience, right?
Yeah, that's a fairly common show. Now there's a point there, the point that you just made in passing, which I think is a really important one, and I'd like you to speak to it a little bit. You said that this is a business transaction. Can you talk about that? Because I think that, at least from my perspective, there are a lot of writers, even published writers, who view what we do as something more esoteric. It's an art.
Yeah.
It's you know, something mystical. And yet we want to get paid for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, you want the best of both worlds, and in truth, it is an art, and you can't not see it as an art. I mean, what you guys produce is art. I mean, I love reading your stuff, and it's that's a challenge of an artist, is to put step in both worlds, and
right.
and there are tricks that you can do, and I write about that in my book. Again, from experts who have done the same sort of thing, and it's almost like you have to play tricks on yourself to allow yourself to be that artistic person, and in fact that person would take everything personally, and you're allowed to, and you should, and then turn it around and be an actual, very objective business person, because those two, you know, it seems like they're an oxymoron, and they are in a way, but there are ways that you can separate yourself without getting what are the things that they do, separate the brain?
Oh, yeah.
Right,
lobotomy,
left.
Lobotomy,
yeah,
without getting a lobotomy.
And I was thinking
and
chainsaw.
And what that is to, when you step into your business role, you keep it business. And that doesn't mean you ignore your other self, but you create a scenario wherein you can see it as a business. And one of the things that I did, I did a lot of short story writing. Both you guys write short stories too, don't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you write quite a bit. The key here is to, in order to objectify yourself a little bit and be more business-like, you create a business scenario. So at any given time, I always had 5 short stories on the go. And with each short story, I studied the market, and I had a list of places that I would send it to. I created literally a nested sort of database sort of thing. And so story A would go to magazine, 1, 2, 3, not all at the same time, unless that was okay. But the point was that every story that was out there had a second place to go to. So once it was out, I knew that when it came back, it was going to go somewhere else. And then I would do the same thing with story B. And I would have these guys out there, a whole bunch of them out there. I would have as many out there as possible. So they were basically making the rounds. So I created, well, I like to call what I had there sort of the bus terminal thing. So it was like a bus terminal thing. Everything came out, went out, and then when it came back, it had a place to go. So I didn't really have much time to go, they didn't want it, mm-hmm. because I already had another place to take it to. And so I took myself out of the emotional place and wrapped that story up. I didn't really think too much about the comments, unless they were, mm-hmm. good comments, then I would do something about the story. But by and large, I didn't change the story at all and sent it off. And I was vindicated in that, because I realized very quickly, by getting acceptances, that, magazine A wouldn't like it, but magazine B would like it just as it was. And there was no point in hanging on to the story and changing it each time. And,
yeah.
of course, I didn't have time to do that if I was treating it that way, like a bus station. So that made it very successful. And next thing you know, I was publishing all over the place.
Well, let's talk about something you just touched on it's fascinating, because this is something I run across all the time with new authors, and that is the emotion that's involved with sending their stories out. And it's like, you got to detach that, because you're absolutely right. I know so many authors that have sent stories out to a publisher. And some editor will send back a rejection letter, and they think they are burned with that editor for the rest of their life.
Yeah,
that they can never, they can never send them anything ever again, because that editor hates them. And it's like, what? Way to know. No. It doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. And the thing is, they put everything into that one story. And I know of people who have stopped dead with the one rejection.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't do anything to that story again. And they won't send it out again.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that's unfair to them. But what it is they don't realize, and it's again, it's the newbie thing. This is why I include examples of letters. And I even talk about the evolution of rejection. Ways to tell when you're getting somewhere with your market. And it's not so much your story, but your market. And see, that's the other key thing. And again, my advice to these to new authors is to, once you get that story out, quickly, as soon as you can, start another one.
Mm-hmm.
And it does two things. It subconsciously severs you from the first one a little bit, right?
I mean,
it's not your baby anymore, because the next one's your baby. And so it's like a... not quite like having a bunch of kids as opposed to one kid, right? But it does make a difference. You're a little bit more relaxed because you've done it with the first one. You've sent it off, and now you're object of attention, and in some cases your emotional link is to the story you're currently working on, and the other one becomes more of a business transaction. That's key, I think, because I think what people often do is they'll just work on the one, polish it like crazy, send it off, and sit there and wait.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
That's got to be the worst thing you can do, because obviously they're going to get rejected.
Yeah.
More likely, right? The stats are in their favor that they're going to get rejected. And whatever that rejection letter says, they are going to take personally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's going to be awful.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And just two things that I'll toss at you. One, I know for me, I collect my rejection slips, and so I'll have all the slips for a particular story. And I remember one story that I had done. I did it on spec for an anthology. It got rejected, and the editor ripped it apart, even though all my friends thought it was brilliant. I sent it to several other places, and the rejections that I got were, oh man, love to use it, but don't have room, not quite, there. And then finally, Roger Zelazny took it for one of his anthologies. And so it was like, well, if Roger likes it, I guess it wasn't a bad story after all.
Exactly, Michael. And that's the neat thing when you keep all the slips, and I do that too, and I use that in my classes because I'm able to show them the variation of responses to the very same story because I never changed it, as you didn't either, right?
No, not at all.
You didn't change your story at all.
Yep.
You just kept sending it out. And it's just, it's amazing. And I've got one where... it was so different. At the one end, they loved it, just loved it. And at the other end, they hated it. And they told me why. I mean, they didn't hate it, but they didn't like it, right? And they told me why. And funnily enough, the guys that really liked it, in fact, liked it for the same reason,
mm-hmm.
well, whatever, the corollary to the other ones, right? So it's... That's important for people to see, and the more you see that, the more you're able to handle rejection as what it actually is.
Well, and going to your bus stop analogy, there was a writer, Hubie Cave, used to write back in the days of the pulps, horror writer, great writer, and a very nice man, who I had the pleasure of befriending. And what he talked about was back in the 30s when he was writing in the pulp era. On his desk, he would have a stack of stories, and when a story came back and was rejected, it would go on top of the pile. And then every day, he would draw a story out from the bottom of the pile, look it over, retype it if necessary, because they obviously couldn't just print out another copy back then, retype the story, put it in an envelope, and send it out. So every single day, something was going out somewhere.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a great story.
And you just keep this stuff going. You know, it's critical to I think do exactly what you've said. You know,
especially if you're trying to make a living at it, you got to eat, and that's what it comes down to.
Right?
Yeah, but, and you want to eat more than paper.
So. Yes, exactly. That's very true. So tell us, what is it that inspires you to go ahead and teach classes and try and pass a lot of this wisdom on to other writers?
Oh man, well, you gotta know the same answer. You do it as well. I mean, mentoring is one of the most satisfying and fulfilling things to do. And as writers, we're communicating all the time, and it's wonderful and satisfying to be able to communicate one on one with people. And I that's what I prefer the most is one on one coaching. I do that a fair bit as well.
Sure.
Online, in person is the best. And just turning on those lights, because they do turn on, and you can see that, you know, in the interaction that you have. And we just work through a problem, and often it's just a very simple thing. And many of them, I could probably name five of the most common things that beginning writers have problems with, because they keep reoccurring. They're all, you know, different scenarios, but all on the same theme. And we work through these things, and next thing you know, they get all excited, and it shows in their eyes, right? And just boing. And in one case, one young fellow got so excited, we actually ended up storyboarding right there, his plot and everything.
Cool.
And it just kept going back and forth between him and I. And he got just so jazzed. He just literally ran. He shot out of there and ran home to his typewriter and started typing a story. It was, and because I know that because his mother actually told me that that's what he's done. It was just so neat, and I get that time and again in workshops. It's a wonderful feeling. I've been a teacher for many years. I'm an environmental consultant, and I do research too, but I also teach. And there's nothing more fulfilling than seeing that happen with people, and you know, getting the inspiration going. It's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you. I think one of the other things is I very much enjoy being in a position to cut through the disinformation, because God, there's a lot of it out there.
Yeah, and as a experienced writer such as yourself, it's, you know, you can do that, right? You know the industry well, you know the typical hurdles that we go through as professional writers, and we can cut through the crap and just tell them, you know, this is the way it is, and this is my experience, and more than not, it's going to relate somehow to what you're going to experience too.
Well, what I think we find fascinating is that the crap stays the same. It never changes.
No, it really doesn't.
I mean, it's weird because
here's words of wisdom: crap is crap.
Absolutely, but 10 years ago we were talking about the same thing that we're talking about now, and it's the same misconceptions over and over and over again.
Oh yeah,
but
this is so funny. I have I don't know, you guys ever read Writer's Digest back in the day? Really, you pick up a current one right now. And it's, my God, it's exactly like the one I read 20 years ago. It's all the same topics. In fact, all the same titles. But, you know, it's written slightly differently. And you're right. It's the same problems or the same challenges. It's just a question of, in this case, repackaging it. But from you and my sake, in terms of teaching people, there are basic things that need learning, and it's great to be able to do that.
Well, and even just being able to say to somebody, "Oh yeah, yeah, I went through that. Everybody does." The
exactly.
Immense relief.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the industry is the industry. Although, if we look at other elements to it, there are some basic things that are changing right now with internet publishing and electronic publishing and a bunch of other stuff that's going on. That's really exciting, but the art of storytelling is still the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the elements of a good story are still there, you know, as they were back in the day of Thomas Hardy versus now. I mean, it's slightly different. They were more verbose then. They used two-syllable words instead of one-syllable words. But the storytelling elements were always there. I mean, Thomas Hardy, to use him as an example again, was amazing at creating metaphor and imagery.
Well, I've got to turn you just a little bit, because we've been talking about how things are the same in the past. What about the future? Mm-hmm. What do you see? I mean, we've been having the ebook conversation. We've been having all of the new electronic forums, the new empowerment of writers and their abilities to get their works out in front of people on their own. So
you know the new, you know what the new form of storytelling is going to be. It's mm-hmm. going to be experiencing the story in its fullest form. Don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, I see gaming, the gaming industry,
mm-hmm.
and the writing industry, and the movie industry all merging together
Ooh.
Into something that's going to be extremely interactive and extremely experiential. I mean, look at reality TV. They're trying to do that in some way, real hokey. Actually, I personally dislike that. Sorry about that,
right.
anybody out there. But to me, it's a lame way of trying to get people into the story right there and experiencing it. And I think the technology is going to give us that. Gaming is like that.
Well, I think the only difference, I've done game design before, and I think the real difference is that any medium which is a graphic medium, like movies, like games, there's less dependence on story. So while I think that technology makes the graphics easier, and you will see an intermediate form of entertainment coming up, but I think there's also going to be that the need for storytellers, and just there's going to be that niche for us who want to sit down and just tell the stories.
True. And I think the traditional storytelling will never stop happening. I mean, and I mean books.
Yeah.
I mean, I think books will always remain. They may become eclectic, and they may not be as mainstream. Let's face it, what's the statistic for youth right now in terms of reading?
Well, actually, in the last U.S. survey, it was up for the youngest group.
Mm-hmm.
Was it?
Yeah, it was.
Well, if you include texting, right?
Well, no. This was the J.K. Rowling bump.
Yeah.
This was the J.K. Rowling kids are actually, they acquired the habit, and now they're still reading.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
It was the numbers were for 2008. It was the every 10-year census of readership in the United States. And these were the numbers. They were the 2008 numbers. They were published last year. But it was a bump for the young demographic, for the Rowling demographic.
That's good. Yep.
So.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I still think this all these other media, I think we're going to see mergers and interesting combinations of media that are going to create different forms of entertainment, much more interactive. I mean, I could see something like Avatar being, that came from a game, although not the movie.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
There was the game, right?
Yeah, there's a game that goes with it. There's always a game now.
Yeah.
There's always a game, exactly. But what I'm saying is the interactive element, the gaming part of storytelling, whichever comes first, come to think of it, where you can choose which way your story goes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that there are limitations, right? That's more along the lines of plot. And most people, I shouldn't say most people, but many people don't realize that there's other elements that are integral to a good story. Even though they enjoy it, they're not quite sure why they enjoy it.
Right.
And those are, of course, things like theme and character and all that come together to create a story with depth, as opposed to simply a plot-related, shallow plot where, oh, let's choose this way of going instead, just out of whim. But there are ways, I think, we're going to be challenged in different ways in terms of telling our stories, more along the lines of showing our stories and letting people experience story and more of a two-way street. And I find that exciting, actually. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
It's not unlike interacting with your readers. It's not unlike blogging. As a new place where people can write and interact with readers in ways that they never could before. I think that's all exciting.
No, I think you're right. I think things will get a little bit more immersive.
Well, I tell you, it has been great having you on. Great conversation. We really
Absolutely.
Enjoy it. It's just a lot of fun.
Oh, cool, Michael.
Right.
It was a pleasure being here and talking with you guys.
All right. Well, we will have links to your book and websites and everything like that. And
you got it.
Guys, we will be right back.
Hey There are tens of thousands of podcasts for you to choose from.
So I was going to play a game of Magic against my friend Kenny, and I really wanted to.
And some of them go on.
Deck, so I went to the store to get and a on. Deck, and the guy behind the counter said he didn't
and
have
on.
A silica deck, and I said I wanted to see.
But every week on Shortcomings Audio, I'll deliver a fresh, new 6-minute humor essay. Shortcomings Audio. Give me 6 minutes, and I'll share my life with you.
We don't sell game cards. This is an office supply store.
All right, just a few seconds here to wrap things up, but I did want to play one thing for you that Tim sent in, and yeah, this is good advice for you.
Hey, guys, this is Tim. Recently on the web page, someone was asking about how to donate to Dragon Page and Four Point below the set cost that's there on the website.
Mm-hmm.
Well, being as I have been contributing to the
forever
guys for well over 2 years now.
Before we even started, I think.
If you go over to the Slice of Sci-Fi website, click on the Donate Now button, you can put in any amount. It doesn't have to be the set amount.
There you go.
And what that does is, if you can only afford $250, then fine. You pay $250. But there's your other option, and it all goes towards the same place. So you're basically doing what you want to do, just a different website. So anyway, talk to you guys later. Hope that helps.
Yeah, realistically, the reason that the donate amounts are the amounts they are is because I don't discourage people from donating a dollar if you want to donate a dollar, but the reality is not a lot of that dollar gets to us.
Yeah, when you I think it's using PayPal out of a dollar, I think you get 67 cents.
Yeah, so, it is. Yeah, so they take
it's
a
really hefty.
They take a major bite out of it when it's under a buck. So $2.50 seems to be the break even point there, where it's $2.50 we actually get the majority of that.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that's
yeah.
that's not so bad. And anything over $5 is fine. And so, but yeah, if you want to, but I'm not going to discourage. I mean, if you want to, donate a dollar, please donate a dollar. Every bit helps. It really does make a difference.
Yeah. We appreciate your support. I mean, we love coming in here and doing this and everything like that, but you know, the practical, you know, there's bandwidth and electricity and equipment to pay for. So.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, we got some ads running, but, those pretty much just buy a whole bunch of servers and bandwidth. So they don't really do a whole lot more than that. There's a lot of costs involved with doing this thing that we do around here. And,
but you know,
every little bit,
we love doing it. So
absolutely. I wouldn't quit. I might have to turn it down a little bit.
There you go.
I'm not going to quit. Anyway, that's going to do it for this show. Thanks so much for tuning in. We love your patronage and your support and your dollars and your comments.
Questions. Visit the website.
Seething rage at iPad use. You know, we love that. Anyway.
And if anybody out there is listening from Apple and you really, really want us to pimp your device,
you can send us a couple.
We'll be okay.
That's right. Send us a couple. We need
two. A couple. That's
we need
true.
Two. Because you're not going to get it from me. That's,
well, I didn't think I would. No, no.
No. Yeah, we'd be fighting
over
it.
Put the gun down. Put the gun down.
That's, you know, that's kind of.